This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. West Virginia, or Central Appalachia, is considered the epicenter of the opioid epidemic. And a shortage of social workers, foster parents, and solutions makes combating the crisis more challenging. West Virginia Public Broadcasting is partnering with Concord University's Social Work and Sociology Department for the second annual Opioid Symposium and Job Fair. This year's theme, Providing Hope. Concord Associate Professor of Social Work and Director of Sponsored Programs, Scott Ingram, says it's not too late to be part of the event. Glennis Board has more.
Scott, tell me a little bit about this event on Wednesday at Concord. What got this started and what's going on?
Well, I really think what got this started is a long discussion that we've had as a department, as an institution, and throughout our communities about the opioid epidemic. We understand that, you know, there are a lot of people who are feeling helpless. They need empowerment. So last year, in collaboration with West Virginia Public Broadcasting inside Appalachia, we started this, and we had such good feedback from our community and felt like we were really meeting some of the need. One of the needs that we feel that we left out, however, was really instilling hope within our community. So we wanted to provide this event and provide resources and knowledge to help combat the issue.
So then tell me a little bit about the day. Let's walk through it. It's a day-long event at Concord in Athens. That's correct?
That is correct. It'll start bright and early at 8:30 in the morning. And it'll start off with six workshops running in two concurrent sessions. And those are workshops that will cover everything from the non-secular work in regard to the issue, Narcan training. We'll have Dr. Brummage, the director of the Drug Office of Drug Control Policy there, to talk about the DHHR's response. Also, we'll talk about the evolving law enforcement response to the issue. Chief Jan Rader will also be there to discuss the response in the Huntington area. And we have some other great speakers that will be there. So they'll be offering continuing education credits for social workers as well for those events and for the events throughout the day. Following those events, we'll have a screening of Netflix documentary Heroin. Both Chief Rader and Elaine McMillian Sheldon will be there for a short question and answer following the film. After the screening, we'll have a town hall discussion hosted by Jessica Lilly with West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Inside Appalachia, and that'll start at 2:45. And that will also feature Dr. Brummage along with other participants throughout the day. And we really were looking for some additional community response, community questions, and we want an open dialogue about the issue and what we can do to help instill hope in our community.
Have you gotten some community feedback? I mean, have people been registering for the event?
We've already had over 150 pre-register. Of course, anybody's welcome to attend, but that helps us do a little planning on the front end, right? And also, I do want to touch base on the community resource fair and employment fair that we're having, where people can come and learn about the resources that are available to them and employers who are trying to deal with the epidemic. You know, we know that people are struggling within our communities to find jobs. We understand that this epidemic also causes hopelessness in our communities. And if we can kind of bridge both gaps that day, we'll walk out feeling like we were successful.
Tell me a little bit more about the job fair. Are there employers who have like registered that are going to be there, or what's that going to be like?
We do have some employers who have pre-registered. However, if you're hearing this and you want to come and you're an employer or a resource provider, please come. We'll make room for you. Basically, we're going to have employers there who are focused on hiring social workers, people who aren't social workers but who are interested in dealing with the issue. And these are private service providers, public service providers.
Can you give me just an example of a type of employer that we might see?
Sure. I think you'll see some mental health facilities there. You'll also see some individuals who, or some organizations who work with foster and adoptive care and the epidemic on the ground.
And that those jobs don't have to be in those specific fields. They can be in any field. Is that correct?
Sure, we'll take you. You know, we have a campus full of young, talented, educated folks who are looking for work. We have a community who we know are looking for work. And if we can help make that connection as a social work department or as an institution, we want to do that. You know, Concord has a rich history of serving our region, and we want to continue that through this symposium and everything that we do.
So you talk a little bit about how you hope that this is going to bring hope to the community or find or be an exchange of ideas and knowledge.
We're solution focused. We want to instill hope through providing resources and solution. You know, a lot of times, and it's a tenet in social work practice and education, that we start with the strengths, and we need to understand what the strengths are. And everybody, every community, every family, everyone has strengths. We need to provide hope through identifying the services and the strengths that we already have.
Is this part of a continuing effort? This is the second event of its kind?
Yeah, it is the second event. We hope to continue this with different themes throughout the years. And, you know, as an institution, we're looking at different ways that we can help deal with this issue. And part of that is reaching out to our communities and understanding their needs. And it's also, as through social work educators, it's understanding what our interventionalists need in order to go out and successfully manage opiate and other addiction issues in our rural areas. Concord has a strong rural-based social work program, and this not only helps inform our community, but it helps to inform tomorrow's education.
Scott Ingram, I really appreciate your time. Thanks for chatting with us.
No, thank you, Glennis. I appreciate your time.
The second annual Opioid Symposium and Job Fair is tomorrow at Concord's Athens campus. You can find more information on our website, wvpublic.org. A representative from the Federal Substance Abuse and Mental Health Service Administration visited West Virginia yesterday to announce an additional $330,000 of funding for opioid abuse prevention and treatment. Kara Lofton reports.
We have a problem that's bringing us to our knees.
That's West Virginia Department of Health and Human Resources Cabinet Secretary Bill Crouch at a press event in Charleston.
Opioid problem and the substance abuse problem affects virtually every family in West Virginia.
Late last year, the Federal Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, known as SAMHSA, awarded West Virginia $5.8 million to combat the opioid epidemic. This week, they announced that West Virginia is one of three states, along with New Hampshire and Massachusetts, that will be awarded an additional $250,000 in an opioid state targeted response grant.
As part of this funding opportunity, what we did was we invited the 10 states that have the highest overdose death rates in the country, West Virginia, of course, being one of them.
That's Eleanor McCants-Katz, Assistant Secretary for Mental Health and Substance Use for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Specifically, what West Virginia will do with these funds is that they are going to establish an innovative and evidence-based approach to identify people with opioid use disorders who are seen in emergency departments, so that those people can immediately get evidence-based treatments, including life-saving medication-assisted treatment, right from the time that they show up and are seeking that help.
But first responders and emergency room personnel often report that people who show up in the emergency room overdosing, or who have recently been brought back with the overdose reversal medication naloxone, aren't always ready to immediately get treatment or enter treatment at all.
One of the efforts we're going to be moving forward with very quickly, and probably in the Charleston area next, are the quick response teams.
That's Secretary Bill Crouch again.
The way that works is you have a team of folks who are responsible for identifying that overdose and going out within 24 hours and finding that individual and trying to convince that individual to go into treatment, to show the benefits of treatment and provide information to that individual. Sometimes that obviously works and sometimes it doesn't. There is no one time that works. It's an individual kind of decision that has to be made. But We believe if we can get out to those folks within 24 hours that we're going to have some success.
Huntington launched a quick response team in the middle of December 2017. In the first 2 weeks, 19 people the quick response team interacted with entered treatment. Crouch says he hopes to replicate Huntington's model in 5 or 6 West Virginia counties. The effort would be spearheaded by the West Virginia DHHR and accompany the ER work allowed by the new federal grant, and hopefully be one more step toward turning the tide of addiction in West Virginia. For Appalachia Health News, I'm Carol Lofton.
Appalachia Health News is a project of West Virginia Public Broadcasting with support from Marshall Health, Charleston Area Medical Center, and WVU Medicine. President Trump's tariffs on imported steel and aluminum are scheduled to take effect at the end of the week. That's encouraged some metals manufacturers in the Ohio Valley to ramp up hiring and production. But other businesses, from bourbon distillers to soybean farmers, worry about retaliation from trade partners. Becca Schimmel reports on the industries that stand to lose out.
Bottles of bourbon make their way through the assembly line at Maker's Mark, one of 10 distilleries on the Kentucky Bourbon Trail. They're cleaned, filled, capped, and then dipped in the signature red wax.
This is where every single label of Maker's Mark is going to come through here.
Bourbon is booming, thanks in part to a strong export market. The Kentucky Distillers Association says bourbon and distilled spirits accounted for more than $450 million in Kentucky exports last year, a 23% increase over the previous year, and nearly half of that went to European Union countries. So when the EU warned of retaliatory tariffs on bourbon, it sent a ripple through the whiskey world. In a quarterly earnings call for the Louisville-based liquor giant Brown-Forman, CEO Paul Varga summed up the concerns.
I mean, if all of this were to come to fruition, the irony, I feel, is that a company like Brown-Forman could be an unfortunate and unintended victim of a policy which, in part, is aimed at promoting something which Brown-Forman is a stellar example of, you know, committed long-term American manufacturing company.
This is a big concern for Kentucky, a state with more whiskey barrels than people, but it's not the only sector in the Ohio Valley nervous about a coming trade war. Spokesperson for the Ohio Farm Bureau Federation, Joe Cornelli, says Ohio farmers are worried about retaliatory tariffs and higher prices for metals materials.
History has shown that agriculture is one of the areas that countries tend to retaliate against quickly because we sell so much agriculture. It's important to us.
Cornelli says the effects of the steel and aluminum tariffs will make it more expensive to farm. He says Ohio's biggest agricultural exports are corn, wheat, and soybean. China has threatened that it will retaliate, and U.S. agriculture is a likely target.
This would be particularly important for Ohio because Ohio exports just over $1,400 million worth of soybeans to China, and China is pretty much Ohio's number one export market for all of its agricultural products.
That's Ian Sheldon, an agricultural economist at Ohio State University. He says it's unlikely that imposing these tariffs will bring jobs back.
The numbers I've seen suggest that for every job potentially recreated in the steel industry, we lose 5 to 8 jobs in those industries downstream that use steel as an important input into their production.
The Ohio Valley is famed as a metal-making region, but many manufacturers here heavily depend on imported materials like steel and aluminum to make their products. The conservative-leaning Tax Foundation published a report ranking states that would be hit hardest by additional costs associated with the steel and aluminum tariffs. Analyst with the foundation, Scott Drenkard, says Ohio ranked in the top 10 of that report. He also says the president's national security argument for tariffs could be a double-edged sword.
There is a little bit of concern that other countries might use that same argument and say, well, we need domestic production of whatever good it may be because that promotes national security in our country.
Drenkard says Ohio manufacturers could see about $500 million in tax increases as a result of the tariffs. While the president is highlighting future gains for steel and aluminum workers, many others in the region worry they could be left behind by his trade policy. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Becca Schimmel in Bowling Green, Kentucky.
The Ohio Valley Resource is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and West Virginia Public Broadcasting. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. Our producer is Liz McCormick. I'm Teresa Wills.